Up next on Technometria, Scott and I talk with Sam Lightstone about his new book, Making It Big in Software, from IT Conversations. Hi, Sam. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Phil. How are you?
Good. Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And Scott, thanks for being here, as always.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah. So Sam, the impetus for this conversation was your recent book, Making It Big on Software. And I love the subtitle, Get the Job, Work the Org, Become Great. Because I think too often we don't really think about the last part, become great. Tell me a little bit about what made you decide you wanted to write this book.
Well, I guess thanks for having me on the show, and thanks for the first question. A couple of things that motivated the book. First, a little bit historical. When I was an undergrad, I was an electrical engineering student at Queen's University, and we used to have these seminars on Friday afternoons. And one day, you know, these seminars were really technical and really boring. I kind of loathed Friday afternoon. We'd have to go to these things, and it was so painful to listen to these technical lectures from usually invited guests from industry talking about, you know, BLSI design or whatnot. And one day a guy showed up. He didn't talk about technical things. He talked about what is our life going to be like when we graduate. And he talked about, you know, the differences between everything we've been taught to learn and know about school and the school environment that we've been embraced in for the most of our lives at that point, and how things were going to change so radically when we got into the workplace. And it was just the most compelling talk to me. It meant so much to me. I really appreciated it. And I vowed to myself that one day, if I could ever return the favor, I would do so. And so when I became a senior manager at IBM and I had enough experience that I understood how software development is done, how it's done at scale, how it's done in large scale industry, I wanted to return that favor and give something back to the community. So I began a series of lectures at leading universities across North America. And the research notes that I built up from those talks really became the basis for Making It Big in Software. That's one dimension. The other dimension is, you know, as I became a senior manager at IBM, and I had a lot of staff, and I sometimes managed very large teams, and I was very active in recruiting, I realized that, you know, it wasn't just the kids in university, but even people within my own team, people who had been in industry for 5, 10, or more years, really hadn't learned the tricks of the trade to proceed in their careers and be effective. So these were really the two aspects that brought me to doing the research, compiling the notes, and then bringing it together in a book was really a natural next step.
Well, one of the things I really enjoyed about the book is it's not just your notes. You also interviewed, I think, 17 people, if I remember right, about, you know, their careers in software, and then interspersed the chapters with those interviews. And I found those to be very interesting.
Yeah, the interviews were a nice touch. I didn't want the book to be just my own thoughts. Certainly the book is a lot more compelling when it has the career ideas of people who have been a major tour de force in the industry, people who have been major forces either on the innovation side, the research side, or on the industrial side, whether that's leading innovators like Ray Tomlinson, who invented email, or Dr. Robert Kahn, who invented the co-inventor of the internet, or on the industrial side, people like Diane Green, who was the co-founder and CEO of VMware. And I really wanted to capture those ideas from across the spectrum of industry and research, young and old, entrepreneurs and people versus people who climb the corporate ladder. And I think, as you pointed out, it adds a nice dimension to the book.
So the book has three parts. It has the first part is fundamentals, and the last part is greatness, and part three is greatness. And those are nice bookends, right? I mean, obviously, if you're going to start in your career, you're going to start on the fundamentals, and we want to achieve greatness. The middle one, you picked leadership. Why?
Oh, great question. So, you know, fundamentals, as you say, is, you know, it applies to all of us. But I think where people tend to stall in their careers is they, over time, will pick up those fundamentals, but they're not able to transition into the leadership qualities. And leadership is, you know, leadership comes in many different forms. There's leadership of people, there's leadership of technology and innovation, and there's a kind of social leadership as well. All of those dimensions, that's where people tend to get stuck. They don't learn those skills. They're not taught in school. And that's really kind of the boundary that people butt up against in their careers, and they stall at around that, 8 to 12 year mark. Their careers tend to plateau because they don't learn those skills. So that's really what that middle section is about. It takes you from being an otherwise really good employee who's maybe a senior programmer or a technical leader or maybe even a junior manager, and helps you propel your career into senior leadership positions.
The first chapter in the leadership section, chapter 9, is working the org. And I suspect that there will be a lot of people, when they pick up this book and read that title, working the org, that will immediately be put off, because I think that of all groups, developers are the most, I won't say apolitical, because I think they actually are political, but they make the most of hating politics. And working the org sounds like politics. So,
it's like gaming the system.
Yeah.
Right. And if you read it, I think you've probably read it already. I'm sure you've seen from what's in there. It's not about being political. It's really about understanding the dynamics, the natural dynamics of an organization. And that's true of, most of the things that I wrote in chapter 9. I would say they break down a little bit if you're in a two-person company, you don't have most of these problems. But as soon as you're in a company of more than about five people, there are organizational dynamics that you have to work with. And it's not about politics. It's not about stabbing people in the back. It's just about understanding that there are competing agendas. You're competing for people's time. You're competing for people's mindset. You want to get people on board. You want to get access to people and resources and funding. And it's not about being political at all. It's really just about knowing how to operate in that environment.
Yeah. And I think that's a great distinction, because one of the things that I distinguish between politics and, let's just call it working the org, is that are you in a place, and does the dynamics of that place work in a way that is a meritocracy? In other words, do good ideas win out, and do people who are good at advancing their ideas win out? Or is it about, who had drinks with who, yesterday at 6 or whatever, right? I mean, because if it's really about do good ideas win out, then if you've got a great idea and you're not a good advocate for that idea and your idea doesn't win, well, then that's not the problem of, you didn't go to drinks with the right people. That's the problem that you're not a good advocate and you need to fix that.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And again, I think that's a big area where people stall, because they don't know how to do that. I mean, it's not taught in school. It's not really taught in industry either. Some people who are savvy, they pick it up by observation, by watching their mentors do it. But if you don't do that, and you don't happen to pick it up by reading a book like mine, then you don't learn it. And then you don't know what to do. You send off an email and you think you've got some great idea that you encapsulated in an email. And, then you're woefully, depressed when your single three-line email didn't change the world. But there's a lot more to getting an idea into motion than sending off a three-line email.
Yeah. I was lucky. My first job out of college, and I did not study computer science as an undergraduate, I studied metallurgical engineering. And my first job out of college was working for Admiral Rickover in the Division of Naval Reactors. And this is an organization of about 300 engineers. And the only thing we produced was letters. But those letters all were about approving or disapproving ideas, and they contained a lot of technical discussion behind the letter, right? I mean, there was hours and hours of technical discussion behind the letter, and that really was an organization where you had to go to bat for your idea. And I spent 4 years doing nothing but going to bat for my idea and what my guys wanted to do, and listening to them and trying to understand the arguments, and then going back to somebody else and saying, no, you don't understand. This is why we've got to do it this way. And it's that kind of give and take that really is, I think, at the heart of what we have to do as engineers. I mean, it's okay to have it's not enough to just have a good idea or to be really bright at manipulating code on the page. You've really got to be able to argue for why this is a good thing. And sometimes you're going to lose, and that's okay, because in the right organization, that's because somebody else had a better idea, and that's what should happen.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. Communication is a huge part of getting your ideas accepted and working in an organization. And it's a great example of how it's not about politics. It's just about being effective and getting your ideas across. So I think you're spot on. One of the areas that I think really bright people stumble in is they come up with a great idea, but however smart you are, your ideas usually can be improved. And people like to jump straight from the great idea to, seeing if they can get it approved or funded, instead of iterating and having those conversations that you're talking about and saying, hey, well, here's my idea. What do you think? And getting the feedback and getting other people's input. Sometimes those people have been around a long time and they got good ideas. Now, a couple of really important dynamics happen in that I think are worth mentioning. The first dynamic is not only do you end up with a better proposal because you've got the input of people who know something that perhaps you didn't, or they come up with creative ideas that perhaps you didn't. But the second thing that happens is that when you collect that input and you get these good ideas from technical leaders or business leaders, and they add this value to your proposal or to your idea, one of the things that happens is they suddenly feel that this idea is partially theirs, It is. It is partially theirs. It's got something. So now, not only do you have a better proposal, but you've got an advocate. You've got a partner. And if you've shopped your ideas around enough and collected enough input and gotten people's ideas, you create a small army of leading people who are your advocates for the idea.
Yeah. You get allies. That's a great point. There was another thing I was going to ask you about that, but it slipped my mind. So I'll just move on maybe. One of the things I thought was interesting in the leadership section was you have, I'd say the chapter on time management is, and the chapter on balance. Those are kind of the things that are, I don't want to say obvious because that sounds pejorative, and I'm not. That's not what I mean. I mean, they're the things you'd expect in this section on leadership. But there were some things which surprised me a little bit. Like on the section on leadership, you have a chapter on avoiding software development overruns and successful project proposals and software management, and those are things that I think are maybe not obvious in this mid-career leadership stage.
Right. So if you think about it, stop for a second and think about who are these people in this midsection of their career. They're people who've been in the business, more than 5 years, but probably less than 20 years. So depending on the size of the company, for a startup, you can be a director of engineering when you're 28. But most companies, if you're not joining a small startup, at that level of your career, that sort of mid-level, you might be a junior manager. You might be an entry-level manager. You might be in charge of an engineering team. And these issues of, software project overruns and managing your time and managing the project's time and managing the people who are in that project, that's a critical part of the leadership that you're expected to show and that you need to show successfully to advance your career. And, it's amazing how most people just don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
And it's a big distinguishing factor between the people who make it from sort of junior managers or entry level managers to senior architects and senior project managers, and a huge difference in their compensation also. I mean, it sounds like a small thing, but man, in software is all about the people. If you look at the cost of a software organization, the cost for the software, for the hardware, for the compilers, it's all peanuts compared to what you're paying the software engineers, program.
Yeah.
So if they're a month late or 6 months late, the cost to the organization, first of all, the cost in terms of salaries is huge, but also the cost of, market share, time to market is huge. So these problems of managing the time, managing your own time, managing project overruns are amongst the most important things that you can do. And in fact, very few things will kill your career more dramatically than being late on deliverables.
Yeah, that's a good point.
it's funny too. I thought it was interesting in the section on just the career advancements on the issues of sort of the unscientific nature of evaluation and advancement and credibility in your reputation. It sort of seems to tie into all of that.
Right. You know, that's a great point. And there's it's funny because there are things in our careers that are very measurable and there are things that are not so measurable. Overruns are very measurable, right? If you're a week late, if you're a week and one day late or a week and 1 hour late, like, man, it's very measurable. It's very quantifiable. So many other things that we work on and, you know, that we're evaluated for are not easily quantified. And if you look at writing code, so, you know, you could be working on some, you know, one programmer who's working on some very complex C or C++ code in a, you know, the back end of a server, and it's, you know, it's highly concurrent and in all kinds of tricky timing scenarios. Or maybe he's working with some very novel hardware interfaces for, you know, solid state devices and so on. And he might only write 3,000 lines of code this year, but the code that he's writing is incredibly delicate, incredibly sophisticated. And some other guy in another part of the organization, you know, he might churn out 30,000 lines of code, but, you know, it wasn't so complicated. It wasn't so difficult. And how do you compare these two guys? I mean, it's like apples and oranges. You know, one guy was incredibly productive on stuff that was not so complicated. This other guy was not terribly productive on something that was incredibly complicated and difficult. And these kinds of, you know, everything in software is like that. It's very, very hard to make, you know, quantitative evaluations between employees. And so there are these interesting dynamics that certain things are very quantifiable, like did you deliver on time? To some extent, did you deliver on quality is a little bit more tangible. And one of the funny things I talk about in the book, and I think I'm probably the first to point this out in a career book, what I call the law of promotability inversion, which is that one of the things that is most easily recognized in software and probably in any technical discipline where expertise is important is, in fact, the expertise. I mean, if you get a bunch of violinists together to play together for an afternoon, you know, within an hour or so, the violinists amongst themselves will know immediately, you know, who is the most virtuoso of the violinists. To the rest of us who aren't expert violin players, you know, it's, you know, we can't tell. They all sound good. But within any group of experts, the expertise is obvious.
Yep.
It's true in sports, it's true in music, and it's true in software. It's true in any software development team amongst the programmers. They all know who the best programmers are. And so while the job tasks that we're working on are very hard to compare because they're so different, the expertise tends to be fairly obvious. And so the expertise actually, although you need to be very productive in your career, you need to get things done, that's certainly extremely important. But your expertise tends to count a little bit more because it is one of the things that's very quantifiable and very easily understood by your peers.
I think the other thing that gets interesting, even in a software, when you get into the team environment, is sort of that diversity of expertise that comes in the team. You know, the architect versus the actual programmer or coder and things like that, the people who can really grok and grab or come up with creative architectural solutions versus people who can actually really code things, you know, extremely well.
Yeah, that's a great point, too. And I think, you know, different organizations will value those a little differently. But most organizations tend to put a little bit more emphasis on the architectural innovation because it tends to be a little bit more rare than the coding prowess. Although I think you'll see that varies a bit from organization to organization. One of the things I did notice, you know, from all the people I interviewed, this point that you're making about diversity of ideas, diversity of experience, many of the people I interviewed commented on how important they felt that was in their careers. And not just a diversity in the software world, but, you know, to the extent that people are studying, you know, some of the people I interviewed were very big names and very big innovators, told me how they, you know, they study physics and they study chemistry and they study economics because they learn from those things. They learn a different way of looking at the world and a different way of solving problems that they can bring to bear on the software problems that they're looking at. And I would say conversely, it also helps them understand places where they can bring their software to bear. So they've really got a bi-directional benefit. Number one, they're learning from these other domains, tricks and approaches that they can use in software, but looking at it from the other dimension, they're looking for and finding places where they can use their software and say, hey, here's where I can use my software to help solve a problem in economics or help solve a problem in finance or help solve a problem in physics.
I didn't want to skip over the first part of the book, but it seemed like going to the leadership section was kind of a natural thing. Because, but I think there's some really interesting things early on too in the fundamentals. You talk about some things like school versus job, which as a CS professor, I've seen this a lot, right? Where people suddenly, everybody in school that I talk to, I says, I can hardly wait till I'm out of school and have a real job. And then everybody that comes back that has a real job says, I wish I was back in school. You know, this seems to be a the grass is greener phenomenon right there. But you do mention in here that, you know, you might not think that you have a well-structured workload when you're in school. But in fact, it's pretty well designed to make sure that students have enough time to get the work done. You get out in the real world, quote unquote, and that's no longer true, right? I mean, there are just physically impossible workloads that somehow have to get done.
Yeah, and everybody's got something different to do in the real world, you know? Like I gave the example before of the two programmers. But, you know, that even that example of the two programmers, you know, those are two guys who have more or less the same job. They're programming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And look how different that is. And compare that to, you know, there are people doing marketing, there are people doing testing, there are people doing project planning. So in fact, I think if you actually break it down item by item, what you'll find is that school and work are not just a little bit different. They're actually kind of opposite. A great example is teamwork. In school, if you work as a team on an exam, so they throw you out. It's called cheating, right? You are expelled from school. Serious, serious ethical violation. In the workplace, if you don't work as a team, they throw you out.
Yeah, that's right.
It's exactly the opposite problem, right? And you know, this is a real area where people struggle when they transition from school to the workplace. The dynamics and what's expected of you is kind of the opposite of everything you've been trained for, you know, the last whatever it is, 15 years of your life, depending on how long you've been in school. It's really kind of the opposite. You're going from a place that's in school where you're getting feedback all the time, every test, every project, every midterm gives you some feedback on how you're doing. The curriculum has a certain structure. Everyone is writing the same exams and doing the same projects. And you transition from that environment to a place where, you know, it's really about the team. It's really about the company. It's really about a highly unstructured environment where you've got to be productive and very dedicated, even though you might only get feedback once or twice a year.
You have a chapter on the early years of your career. Talk a little bit about what developers face in the early years, other than what we just talked about with the obvious differences between school. But I mean, those are some critical years. And I think a lot of times, at least people I talk to that have come back and talked to me after they've gone out and got a job, sometimes that's boring. You know, it's not everything they dreamed a career in software development would be.
Sure. Well, okay. So let me speak to a couple things there. And I'll speak to what I think some of the interesting challenges are, but I also want to come back and speak to the comment that you just made, that what people are telling you, how it can be boring. First of all, what are some of the big challenges in those early years? The first thing is learning to develop software at scale. You know, when you're in school and you're learning programming, either at the theoretical level or the practical level, you never really get the experience to develop software at scale. What do I mean by at scale? I mean, first of all, the software itself has to perform at scale. Performing meaning it's got to be able to run for, you know, terabytes of data, potentially thousands of concurrent users. That's usually a scale of execution that you don't have to worry about at school. Second of all, often you are in an environment, depending on the size of your organization, where you're developing on code that has a very large engineering team. Now, large is, you know, depends on the company and depends on the organization, but you know, whether it's 10 people or 100 people or 500 people, it's usually a lot larger than the scale of what you had to deal with in school projects. That's in terms of the people, number of people who are writing and touching the code and modifying the code. The third thing is that in school, you tend to work on projects. Excuse me. You tend to work on projects that have a history to them. So the code is building up over time, and you end up with code bases of 100,000 lines of code, a million lines of code, and so on. It's a scale that just doesn't exist in school. And, you know, it's a totally different mindset of learning how to program when there's a code base of a million lines of code and it's going to exist in 5 years. And whatever you write today, you know, you're not going to remember it 5 years from now. And you might not even be around 5 years from now, or someone else who wrote that code that you're now responsible for. They're not around to ask questions of. So this whole idea of writing, developing at scale, whether it's the code that's at scale, the organization that's at scale, or the usage dynamics that are at scale, that is a major, major difference, technical difference that people need to grapple with in those early years.
Yeah, one of the things that makes me think about is that, you know, most students don't learn very much about version control. And even if they do use version control, what they're working on is generally not big enough or dynamic enough that they've had much experience with things like branches and, you know, all of the other, you know, kind of more esoteric parts of version control that happen all the time in a large software project.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, it's all about this problem of developing at scale. So I think you're 100% right. And, you know, it doesn't take that long to get used to, but it does take some getting used to, and people who don't get there are very seriously handicapped. The other thing I think is a big distinction, and just looking at the technical attributes of those early years, is really transitioning from a person who knows some of the theory to being a person who's really has a certain software professionalism about that. Now, at the technical level, if you just think about it, at the technical programming level, you know, how many programmers really understand, you know, the performance characteristics of programming in Perl versus programming in Java versus programming in C or C++? How many programmers are really sensitive to the difference of, you know, accessing instructions at data that is co-located with level 2 cache versus going to local memory? How many people really understand the difference between large block I/O, small block I/O, and random I/O? These are things that, you know, when you want to develop professional software that's used en masse by hopefully a lot of customers, right? You want to have lots of customers for what you're building. You got to worry about these things. And, you know, these are problems that you might learn about theoretically at school. But you get into the workplace, it's the people who have, you know, so to speak, tinkered. They've been hacking around and tinkering and doing some measurements on their own time and getting a feel for it, saying, hey, you know, this stuff scales, this stuff doesn't scale, this performs, this won't perform. They have a big technical advantage in their career. And the interesting thing is that, you know, although languages tend to come and go and platforms come and go, the principles of computer architecture and the principles of software engineering tend to have a lot more longevity to them. And so you pick up these skills, they tend to last for a long, long while. But I want to come back to the, you know, what you said, some of your students were coming back to you with saying things are boring. One of the things that people often don't realize in those early years is that they have an unstated privilege. They have an unstated privilege when you're in a software engineering team to pursue your dreams and to explore and to innovate. Most of the great innovative ideas in any company are not coming from the CEO or the CTO. It's a myth. It's a complete myth, right? The big ideas, the innovation is coming from the grassroots. People come up with new ideas. They explore things on their own time. And they have fun doing it. And when they come up with some good idea that they've been tinkering with, you know, in a couple hours a week, they say, hey, look at this. I got a demo. I can show this to my boss. He'll show it to his boss. You know, you can start socializing it in the way that we talked about earlier a few minutes ago, shopping it around, getting feedback, and refining it. That is not only, I mean, first of all, that is how great innovative ideas come to play. That is how, for example, email came to play. When I interviewed Ray Tomlinson in the book, he talked about how he invented email. I mean, he was really just tinkering, mm-hmm. right? Nobody told him go invent email.
Yeah.
A lot of great ideas come about that way. And it's a fantastic way to have fun. You know, you can have a lot of fun doing these kinds of things that nobody really asked you to do. And certainly in my career, that's what I've done. I've always made a point of spending some number of hours a week on my own agenda. And, you know, usually after hours, but that's okay with me. I don't mind spending a few hours a week of overtime if it's on my own agenda, my own innovation, my own fun. And not only does it help you have fun and enjoy your career, but you know, at the end of the day, that's what's going to propel your career, because you've made a substantial difference. You've driven some innovation or some new business ideas or helped some other people in a way that, you know, you were not initially asked to do.
One of the things I tell my students is don't confuse your job with your career. And I think what you just said is a great example of that, that your job is when someone says, go program this module or whatever, you go program that module to the spec. That's kind of your job, right? But your career requires, in fact, doing things like going out and trying something that nobody asked you to do because you think would be fun or interesting.
Right, exactly.
The one thing that I find in that I think is the second half that kind of gets lost in the power of that is it's not just you going off creatively doing your own thing, but it's then sharing that with other people and getting their feedback. And there's sort of your creativity and going and creating that experimental thing is kind of neat on its own. But once you go out and start showing it to other people is when all of a sudden, you know, they get interested by what you've done. They give you feedback on it that you might not have ever thought of. And again, it's that thing that sort of catalyzes, you know, real creativity and innovation.
And that's fun. That's the fun part.
Yeah. Right. You guys are bang on. I'll add one other thing to what you said, which is one of the hesitations that people have is they think, oh, if I show this to my peers, if I show this to too many people, other aggressive people are going to want in. They're going to want to contribute, and they're going to want to take over. They're going to want to say, hey, it was their idea. Look what they did. I don't want that to happen because it's my idea. I'm the guy who started it. I want to keep control, la, la, la. It's a natural reaction. Most people have it, especially, you know, coming from the school environment where it's all about your personal contribution. But in fact, you know, it's the worst thing that you can do, because getting other people involved, getting other people to be enthusiastic is always helpful. It's helpful. You'll end up with a better prototype or a better idea. You'll have more people who are advocates for the idea. But, you know, you never really have to worry about losing the credit. You know, people are always going to remember where that idea came from, as long as you make a modest effort to remind them and keep it, you know, keep it a fact of record that this came from you originally. And, you know, it's that fear of losing control, losing credit, that stops a lot of these ideas from moving forward. And if people just get past that and really just try to socialize their ideas and trust the organization, trust that your organization is not built up of a bunch of jerks, but that most of the people in the organization will give credit where it's due, and their memories will extend far enough back to remember who was the guy who came up with the original idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So you interviewed a bunch of people for this book. What are a couple of things you learned from those interviews that you hadn't thought of before?
Okay. Interesting. Well, first of all, there are a number of personalities who really impressed me. I was very impressed by Marissa Mayer, by Mark Russinovich, by James Gosling, and a few others who are just really profound personalities who are, you know, once when I interviewed them, I just said, wow, you know, these are people who deserve, you can see why they made it big. They deserve all the credit. They're just such dynamic personalities and who think in such broad and mature ways. One of the ideas that I thought was very interesting was an idea raised by Mark Russinovich, who's now technical fellow at Microsoft, which is their highest technical level in the company. And he's one of the gurus and architects of Windows. At the time I was writing the book, and I had been doing some research on the popularity of different programs. And I, you know, you can find it in the book, in the first section of the book, which programming languages are hot and which are not. And certainly Java, C, and C++ are dominant. And I have a histogram in the book where I say, hey, you know, there's the popularity of each language, such and such percent for each one. And I think I studied about 25 different languages in the analysis. So, you know, Java is number one. And comes along Mark Russinovich, and I said to him, you know, what advice do you have for other people? And he said, you know, you got to try to distinguish yourself. He said, when Java came out and Java started to become a popular programming language, everybody wanted to be a Java programmer. After all, it's the most popular programming language. Shouldn't that be the one you're going to learn? Isn't that where all the jobs are? But the problem with that line of thinking is that you end up with you know, an incredible population, a large population of cookie cutter Java programmers.
Yeah, it's kind of the blue ocean, red oceans thing.
Yeah. So how are you going to distinguish yourself in that? So he said his trick was, you know, he became an expert in operating systems. Operating systems was, you know, it's somewhat more niche, but it's something that's, it's got a life to it. It's going to, there's always a need for operating systems. And so he felt his skills were long-term, but they were niche. And that's what helped distinguish him in his career.
Yeah. That's an interesting concept.
Yeah. Let me see if I can pick a few others for you. Oh, yeah, another one that I thought was rather profound. I don't think he meant it quite as profoundly as I took it, but I interviewed Linus Torvalds, who was the original creator of the Linux kernel. And, you know, all of us who work in the industry, we're always talking about innovation, innovate, innovate, innovate. We're always looking for the innovative ideas. And at the time that I interviewed Linus, I was writing my chapter 17 on innovation. All my great ideas on how to innovate, how you're going to foster innovation in an organization. And then he said to me, you know what? You know what bugs me about software? People think that innovation is the big, hard thing. Poppycock, says Linus Torvalds. Right? The hard thing is following through on the innovation. Mm-hmm. Innovative yeah. ideas are not that rare in the end. So I thought about that and I went back, is he right? And I played the following sort of hypothetical scenario with myself. So imagine that you have a group of five people, maybe the three of us and a couple of others, and we get together for 15 minutes and we brainstorm what are some innovative things that we could do to make some improvements to Facebook. And I'll bet you get five intelligent people together and you brainstorm for 15, 20 minutes. We'll come up with some reasonably good ideas on how to improve Facebook. And it doesn't matter if it's Facebook or some other problem you're working on. You get a bunch of reasonably intelligent people together and you brainstorm for a bit, you'll come up with good ideas. Mm-hmm. So what that teaches you, I mean, we've all had that experience, hopefully, so we know that to be true. So if you think about it, you suddenly realize, yeah, you know, he's got a point. The innovative ideas are super important, but they're not that rare because we can all do it. Yeah. If we can all do it, how rare is it? It's the follow through. It's the combination of coming up with the idea and following through on it that really is what doesn't happen so often. It takes a tremendous tenacity of spirit to take these, you know, kernels of ideas and really follow through on them, especially when nobody's asking you to, especially when it means, you know, taking resources away from something else that's already been committed to a plan and committed to the business and arguing for, you know, part of those resources to be diverted to a new effort.
Yeah.
So that struck me as being rather profound. And I don't know if he meant it quite that way, but I think that whether he did or didn't, he was certainly on to a really important point.
That is. That's a real fascinating thing. It's sort of the conversion of the idea from neurons into, you know, bits or atoms is really the you know, at a high level, that is what really is the skill.
Yeah, I think you're bang on. I like that analogy, the conversion of the neurons to the bits.
You have a chapter in the last section, the, you know, being great section, or becoming greatness is what it's called, about startups. And I think that it doesn't really matter whether it's a startup in the sense that we all understand of being a, you know, you go start a LLC and you get some money and hire some people and all of that, or whether it's, you know, you start an idea inside a company and gather the resources necessary to make it happen. In both of those cases, you're starting something up, and it's exactly this that you were just talking about. I mean, it's not the individual idea; it's the pulling together of resources and building the organization and convincing people and gathering, you know, allies and all of that that's necessary to turn that idea into something that's real.
Yeah, you're 100% right. And the beautiful part is, you know, if you really have a good idea and it really meshes with what the people who you're pitching it to are all about, and that's a key point, you have to be able to speak to their competencies and to their core competencies as a business, but also be able to speak to what they're interested in investing in. But if you've got a good idea that does speak to what they, you know, what they're looking to build a message around, then you've got a really good chance all the time of getting that funding, as long as you can make it compelling. And there are very few cases where you can't get the funding if you've got a good idea and if you're willing to start modestly.
Yeah, and you know, early in the book, you talk about finding a mentor, and I think that this whole process that you have later of starting something up, whether it be a business or a project inside a company or whatever, there's a lot of advice out there, and you need to find the people who can help you learn those skills, because that's the only way you can figure it out. I mean, if you're inside, I mean, well, you work in IBM, right? I mean, I'm sure you have had a lot of mentors who have helped you understand how IBM works. And if you want to do this, here's what you got to do. I mean, that's, right. Yeah.
It's hugely important. And I'll give first of all, for myself, you're 100% right. I've had great mentors over the years, and I would not have been able to achieve a fraction of what I have in my career without them. I was completely clueless. I mean, I had no idea. when I graduated, I had no idea how organizations work. It was completely, completely clueless. And it was only through the mentoring of wise and experienced people that I figured it all out. But I want to give you a classic example, an example that everybody's probably vaguely aware of, but maybe hasn't reflected on. And that's Google. The Google Corporation started with Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who founded Google when they were, you know, grad students at Stanford. And, you know, brilliant guys, they had a brilliant idea, and they founded this Google Corporation. But, you know, one of the things I give them the most credit for is that they realized pretty early on that they were technicians, right? They were not businessmen. They're Stanford University grad students. And so after the company started to get some traction, they went out and they looked for a CEO, and they ended up hiring Eric Schmidt, who's now the CEO of Google. And it was Eric Schmidt who really taught them and helped them and drove the company on the business side. It takes a lot of modesty, actually, and a lot of courage to come to that realization that, hey, you know, you've got a great idea, but you're an engineer, you're not a businessman, and go and get that help. And, you know, the example I gave you with Google is an example that's, you know, it's a famous example, it's a corporate example, but you are 100% right that that example, that model exists within organizations as well. So if you've got a great idea, large or small, maybe it's only an incremental idea to an existing product or an existing process, it really helps to pull in people who understand the organizational dynamics and the business dynamics, and expand your idea and foster your idea in those other dimensions that maybe you're not as skilled in. And probably the biggest area where people fall down is in showing the business model and the business, the market analysis and the business value of their ideas. It's not something that engineers are trained to do. And they usually don't have a much of a clue on how to do the market analysis and the business plan. And often, especially if you're pitching within an existing organization, you don't need a fancy plan. You don't need PhD level, you know, super expensive market analysis. But you need something. You need some bit of analysis that says this idea will fly. This idea will be useful to us, and the usefulness will exceed the cost. And it's really helpful to pull in some people who have the experience in doing those things to help augment that aspect of your work.
So you end the book with a chapter called Making It Big. So why don't you tell us at the end of this discussion we've been having, what does it mean to make it big, and who makes it?
Okay, great question. The first thing I'll say, and I touch on this theme throughout the book, is that making it big is a very subjective quality, and it means something different to different people. Even if I look at the major industrial personalities that I interviewed in the book, it meant different things to some and to others. For some, it was really about the challenge of solving hard engineering problems. They love to go into work and be able to work on the hardest problems they can find. Steve Wozniak is a great example of that. You know, when I interviewed Steve, I said, Steve, you know, you changed the world. He says, I don't care. I don't care I changed the world. I don't care that I brought personal computing to the every living room in North America.
Yeah,
I couldn't care less. All I care about is I got to work on hard problems, and I solve problems, you know, elegantly. I solve problems with fewer instructions than anybody else that ever solved those problems. I'm proud of, you know, my bytecode.
Right.
That's what making it big meant to him. And then there's other people, you know, I spoke to Peter Norvig, is the director of research at Google. And, you know, he has the famous quote that he's, he he's answered more queries than anyone else in the history of the world. So it's a funny quote from a guy who works at Google, but you know, I asked him, you know, what is it for you? And he said, well, I like that I've done something that matters to people. So completely the opposite approach. So it means something different to different people. But I think in all these cases, in order to make it big, you have to know how to work the org. You have to know how to play the dynamics of the situation. And it's not about being political. It's not about being mean and nasty. In fact, I think it is, on the contrary, it's more about being nice to people and communicating and getting everyone on board. I'll just finish with maybe one final thought, which is that some people don't want it, right? Some people, they want to be home at 5 o'clock to spend time with their family, and their career is not that important in their lives. As long as they have money to put food on the table and pay the bills, they're happy. And that's a very respectable thing as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's okay. We've all worked with people like that, and they get stuff done. And that's, every organization needs a lot of those.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, but I guess my contention is, whatever it is you want to achieve, even if you're the person who wants to leave at 5 o'clock sharp and never work a dime of overtime, whatever it is you want to achieve, in the hours that you're at work, you're there anyway. You might as well make the most of it. So usually with a little bit of concerted effort and a little bit of strategic thinking, you can get more done in your career, achieve a higher level of professional satisfaction and accomplishment without putting in more hours, just by being savvy on how you're using that time.
Yeah, very, very good stuff, Sam. This has been very interesting, and I'm sure that we'll get to meet someday, and I look forward to that.
All right, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Scott, thanks.
Yep, great book.
Bye now. You've been listening to Technometria. For more of Technometria, please visit my weblog at www.windley.com.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Paul Figiani. Our website editor was Joel Cherney. The series producer is Joel Cherney.
My name is Phil Windley, and I hope you join me next time for another edition of Technometria on IT Conversations.